We live in an era of big problems and tend to spend our time thinking of big solutions. But what if the answer is really in small solutions? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this hour include Courtney White, author of the new book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. Also joining us, Jeff Biggers, author and founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. He's just written an op-ed piece for the New York Times called Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom. Small solutions for big environmental problems. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the introduction to his new book, my guest this hour, Courtney White, points to the seemingly intractable challenges we face, the increasing concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, rising food demands from a population on our globe that's projected to rise from the current 7 billion to 9 billion people by 2050, and the dwindling supplies of fresh water, to name just three. White says that most of these challenges mean big solutions with big costs, both financial and social, and this raised a question in his mind a few years ago. Why not consider low-cost, low-tech, nature-based solutions instead? And these questions, this question became the focus of White's new book. It's titled 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. Courtney White joins us by phone for the entire hour. He's a former archaeologist and Sierra Club activist. In 1997, he co-founded the Kivira Coalition. That's a nonprofit dedicated to building bridges between ranchers, conservationists, public land managers, scientists, and others around practices that improve land health. He joins us by phone. Courtney White, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Let's start by having you explain the title, the idea behind this book, 2%. What does 2% have to do with it?
Well, yeah, it means a couple different things. And I should say first that the book is kind of a sequel to a book I wrote a couple years ago called Grass, Soil, Hope, which looked at the potential for plants, rangelands, grasslands to sequester carbon in soils, lots of carbon dioxide floating around the atmosphere, too much of it in many ways. How could we sequester some of it in a carbon sink called the soil? And so I looked at that in that book, and as a consequence, it led me to this 2% solutions idea, which is if we can increase soil carbon by just 2%, we get all kinds of positive benefits. And folks who are listening are gardeners or farmers. They know that dark, rich soil is carbon mostly. So for only 2% more increase, you get more productivity, more water holding capacity, bigger plants to grow. And then also the labor pool to do this work is only 2%. So it's only 2% of the population, farmers and ranchers largely. And finally, for only 2% of the GDP, which is a number I sort of picked out of the air to demonstrate that it's not a lot of money. So just a small fraction of money done by a small fraction of the population, increasing soil carbon by a small fraction, you get all kinds of beneficial, sustainable, resilient, regenerative solutions to a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit of the backstory at how you arrived at this low-tech, low-cost, these natural ways of getting carbon back into the soil.
Well, I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm a conservationist. And 20 years ago, I started a nonprofit to work with ranchers out here on some low-cost, nature-based practices and how to kind of manage animals more in nature's image out here. And in the process of running the nonprofit and meeting a lot of farmers and ranchers and conservationists doing cool, innovative, progressive things, I began to realize that there were a suite of practices that most folks were not hearing about. You weren't hearing about it in the mainstream media. It was kind of off the grid, kind of grassroots type solutions to a number of problems. But it wasn't until 2009 when I realized that there was a climate connection here, that these practices that were reinvigorating plants and soils and people also could address climate change through carbon sequestration in soils. And that's, you know, that's when I got excited, and that's when I decided to put whatever literary skills I had to work to write about this and try to get the word out more broadly.
Okay, you have in this book 2% Solutions for the Planet. You have 50 of them. Let's talk about some of the practices. Have you explained some of the practices? And some of these practices are certainly being used here in Iowa, in the Midwest already. And that was sort of the idea behind these, is that you don't need to invent anything new here. That was what was behind some of these practices. So let's go to one here. And if I can tip off to this first one by quoting you, you write, "If we could do one thing for the planet, I'd vote for ditching the plow."
Right, and that was news to me. Again, my background is in ranching and conservation out west. I hadn't really thought about farming too much. It wasn't until I started looking at soil carbon, and what we mean by that is biology, soil biology, the microbes and the nematodes and protozoas that make soil healthy. They're key to all kinds of things in the soil. But when we plow, I was told, and when I did some research, that when we plow it, we turn it over, most of that biological life in the soil dies. It gets exposed to air, to heat, to the erosive effects of wind and water, and all that biological activity, or a lot of it, washes away. And so then we need fertility in forms of chemicals and things to bring that fertility back. So, so there's a movement afoot. I think there's a fair amount of it in Iowa called no-till, which is just, you know, just what it sounds like, a no-till practice that doesn't turn the soil over, keeps those carbon stocks and that biological life going in the soil. And so it's a no-till drill that makes a small furrow or cut in the soil, and then cover cropping is placed atop it, so everything stays in place, is protected, is moist year-round, and so that fertility, the biological activity continues, and all kinds of good stuff follow.
Mm-hmm. And when you're visiting Iowa, in the Midwest, driving around at certain times of the year, you certainly notice that there aren't as many fields that are plowed up, where you see just soil that perhaps we remember from our childhood. Every single field looked like that. It was plowed up. And now I think must be the majority are not plowed up. Or do you have a sense of nationwide how widespread no-till practices are?
Well, no, but I know there's USDA and some other folks have those numbers. But in the book, I describe organic no-till, which is a little bit different. No-till, the cover cropping process keeps the soil covered. However, weeds become a problem, and one of the responses to no-till is to spray for weeds, and that's detrimental to biological life in the soil. So some farmers, particularly ones at the Rodale Institute in eastern Pennsylvania, came up with an organic no-till process. I'm not sure we're going to go into details. It's a roller crimper that crimps the cover crop without killing it, and then the weeds come up through it, so there's no spraying. And I think, to answer your question, that's not widespread. I mean, it's on the way. More and more folks are doing organic no-till. But right now, most no-till is still herbicide-based, which can lead to trouble.
Courtney White is my guest this hour. 2% Solutions for the Planet, his new book, 50 Low-Cost, Low-Tech, Nature-Based Practices for Combating Hunger, Drought, and Climate Change. I wonder if you can give us more of a sense of some of these solutions. Highlight a few of them that are probably of interest to us here in the Midwest, Courtney.
Well, in the farming, the book is divided into five parts: farming, ranching, technology, restoration, and wildness. And that's wild animals mostly. So, in the technology section, which I find really sort of most hopeful, because there's a lot going on that meshes high technology with, I guess you'd call it, low technology farming, particularly among younger people. There's a story in there about Doran Cox, who's a farmer in New Hampshire, who grew up on an organic farm, was told there's no future in farming, so he left and he went into high-tech software companies, came back to the farm and brought with him a whole bunch of new stuff about systems theory and technology, and he's been managing his family farm in a very different way. So he uses computing power to analyze data on the farm. He started a online group. He calls it a virtual cafe called Farm Hack, where he links other farms around him together. They invent stuff. They share stuff. None of it's proprietary. It's all open source, and he's using high-tech imagery to manage the farm. He's a great saying. He says, farming isn't rocket science. It's more complicated than that. And and I think that shows you how young people are blending the power of new technology with the old technology of growing food organically in a way that I find very hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you a farming problem, agricultural problem that's been in our news, and see how your solutions could possibly tackle that. In Iowa, farmers are being asked to make some changes in the way they farm voluntarily come in with the nutrient reduction strategy. Some believe that nutrient reduction strategy in our waters, our bodies of water, should be mandatory. And you've probably heard of the Des Moines Water Works in the midst of a lawsuit with three Northwest Iowa drainage districts for violating the Safe Drinking Water Act. Officials at the Des Moines Water Utility say they need almost $200 million to update its system to treat water for 500,000 customers, saying essentially it's due to runoff from farm fields. What's your reaction to that, or solutions for that?
So not being from Iowa, by nutrient management, you mean fertilizer, I assume. Is that right? Nitrogen-based fertilizer, the stuff that's put on the farms, is that correct?
Right, right.
Okay.
It's non-source, non-point source pollution, I guess is the term.
Yeah. Well, the farming systems and the ranching systems that are in the book don't use synthetic or industrially produced chemicals or fertilizers. The way I describe it in the book is that nature knows best, and so the farmers and ranchers out here use practices that are biologically based. So the fertility comes from microorganisms in the soil, from animal manure, from careful movement of animals across landscapes. So to answer your question, I'm not sure how to prescribe or regulate the nutrient management systems. What we propose, the folks in the book and folks I work with, really kind of an alternate model, I guess, to that. You know,
well, just no-till would reduce the amount of runoff.
Right.
That's true.
So things that reduce erosion, and there's a whole section in the book on ecological restoration projects, because we have a lot of damaged land out west here. And there's lots of stuff going on how to restore those landscapes simply and effectively to slow erosion. So anything that slows erosion on farmland, cover cropping being probably the simplest way to do that, get something green and growing all the time, hopefully without a lot of synthetic fertilizer making them turn green and help them grow.
Back to the point of no-till work. Eric and Ames emails, the vast majority of Iowa farmers around me do till, and Emily Woodbury, our producer here, did some quick research here, finding that the use of no-tillage farming has grown sharply over the last decade to about 35% of cropland in the United States. So that's a sizable portion.
It is, and it shows how these ideas spread quickly. I mean, it's more profitable. It's more productive. Folks are finding, there's an old saying I from years and years ago. It was an agronomist in Ohio, I believe, who said that there's no scientific reason to till, which is kind of an interesting way to think about it. What I think folks are finding out now, that there's a lot of reasons to no-till, to kind of keep that cover crop in place, and then reduce erosion and have more profit. So I'm not surprised to hear that this idea is spreading quickly. But I couldn't tell you about the numbers.
Okay. That was actually courtesy of one of our listeners. Eric was the one who emailed that in there, according to no-till farmer. 96 million acres in the U.S. are no-till, 35% with 10 million that use cover crops. So significant progress there. If you just joined us, my guest is Courtney White, 2% Solutions for the Planet, his new book, where he outlines 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Also joining us this hour, Jeff Biggers. He's author and writer-in-residence and founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. Jeff is in our Iowa City studio. He just wrote an op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times called Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom. Jeff Biggers, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And it was interesting that this your op-ed coincides with our conversation today. Let me just quote a line or two from your op-ed and have you explain it a little bit. A new climate change narrative is emerging among farmers in the American heartland that transcends a lot of the old storylines of denial and cynicism and offers an updated tale of climate hope. Describe the shift in the narrative you see among Midwest farmers.
Well, you know, Ben, I for years have been following the coal industry as both a journalist and a historian. And so I arrived here in Iowa a little over 3 years ago and really began to look at the role of farmers. And I think what shocked me was to realize that there, in fact, was a new narrative coming out, not only a matter of farmers using sort of a common sense approach and sort of leading the vanguard and putting solar panels up on their barns and feedlots and whatnot and being part of the whole wind energy revolution, but realizing that Iowa could be a front line for climate action and climate solutions. And that's when I began to look at various farms and young farmers like Grant Schultz who were seeing how they could change in a very slow process. We began to change the tide from seeing Iowa as basically part of the problem with industrial agriculture to shifting toward more regenerative agricultural issues and making it really one of the solutions.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about solutions, you are talking about some of the same solutions that Courtney White is in his new book.
Exactly. We're looking at soil carbon sequestration efforts through regenerative agriculture, through organic farming, through a whole host of activities that are happening now in the rural areas that really give me a lot of hope in terms of the climate change issue.
What's driving the change in narrative? Is it a top-down thing or a thing that farmers are getting together themselves? What's the change agent here?
I think the change agent is also in how we speak about it. Part of why we created the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa was to say, hey, we have this mountain of studies. Every week, like you, I get an email saying, here's the new wake-up call. Here's the new study. You know, 99% of the scientists believe, you know, about human-induced climate change. But there was very little action. And we really sat down for a long time and said, how do we take all this great science and package in a way that we can begin to reach people? And we said, it's a matter of communication. It's a matter of becoming storytellers. You know, the city of literature really needs to become the city of climate action. How we'll do that is through our legacy of telling stories, through theater and art and film, and we've even had dance students. And so that's how we began to shift and look at what's happening in the rural areas with farmers, is that we feel like we just haven't told the story well enough to give the spotlight on people who are doing some extraordinary things.
Jeff Biggers, in your op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times, Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom, you point to, you mentioned his name, Grant Schultz, a farmer in Johnson County. He's actually founder of something called Versa Land, and he's in our Iowa City studio as well. Hello, Grant.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Tell us about the practices that you've put in place, and I think something like 3 years you've been farming or on this particular land and founding Versa Land. You can tell us about that too. Tell us about the practices you have in the context of our conversation here.
Sure. So my farm is 145 acres. It was effectively converted from a monocultural row crop farm, conventional Iowa corn or soybean farm, and completely converted into a perennial-based system. So we literally seeded over every square inch that used to be soybeans or corn into a perennial-based forage, alfalfa grass, you know, that kind of thing. And then on contour, planted rows of trees back into that. So we're creating a savanna type of environment a mimic, an agroecological mimic of what Iowa once was, so that we can graze livestock on this forage in the alleyways, and we can raise tree crops for carbohydrates and proteins and fats. So we're producing all the same agricultural commodities or similar ones, effectively filling the same role, but we're doing it without tillage. We're doing it without any chemical application whatsoever, and we're producing a profitable farm in the meantime.
Okay. That was my question. How profitable compared to what it used to be, row crops?
Sure. It depends on the year. I mean, commodity agriculture is very variable year in, year out. Our input costs are much, much lower. I'm not applying any anhydrous ammonia. I'm not applying any Roundup. So my inputs are effectively zero after the first seeding, And in the short term, this natural transition period of waiting for these perennial crops to mature, you're seeing, lesser cash flows. You plant an apple tree on day one, you're not going to see any money out of it for 5 to 7 years, right? In the meantime, I can be grazing livestock right away, and I'm getting immediate yields by harvesting that forage and running it through an animal versus the alternative of burning diesel fuel, go harvest that crop, haul it to a building, feed it to the animal, and then process it. So my inputs are much lower. Profitability in the short term is probably at par with the conventional operation, but in the very near future, hopefully in this 5-year timeline, it's going to be more profitable per acre than a conventional row crop operation.
More profitable primarily because you don't have all those inputs.
Correct. And I'm producing, higher quality yields, organic, grass-fed.
You can sell them for higher prices.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Courtney White, we have to go to break in just a minute or two, but when you hear Grant Schultz describe his farm, I guess several of the solutions you describe in your book are right there, aren't they?
Absolutely. And it's really exciting and encouraging to hear a story like that. And I agree with Jeff entirely that telling Grant's story plus all the others is key here, and that's exactly what I try to do in the book.
Mm-hmm. So really, Jeff Biggers, it is the case that unless we tell the story, farmers won't consider it. We'll say, I didn't think of that. We tend to think that market forces will drive us to the best solutions, but you're saying we need to be told a new story?
I think we need to be told a new story, but also an old story of what Iowa once was like. Remember, I think we tend to forget that Iowa is probably has the most altered landscape in the country, if not the world. We've lost, of course, over the past two centuries, 99% of our native prairies. And I think if we begin to see what Grant is doing and so many other farmers as well, we can begin to tell a new story of a regenerative approach of restoration. And once again, I should probably define that regenerative idea. By regenerative, we mean not just to do less harm, but to begin to enhance and restore the damage that has been done to the land.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, how would you sum up the damage to the land? I mean, you said 99% of it has been altered from what it was.
Right.
I mean, in all areas, the water, for instance, with the erosion.
With the erosion and ultimately the impact. I think what we're seeing now, even with industrial agriculture, that with increasing volatile experiences of drought and flooding and the creeping reality of climate change, they're realizing, too, they must, shift, have some sort of shift and begin to look at other measures, which is exactly what Grant is doing.
Jeff Biggers is with us, founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. Courtney White, author of the new book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 Low-Cost, Low-Tech, Nature-Based Practices for Combating Hunger, Drought, and Climate Change. Grant Schultz is a founder of VersaLand, and he's just been describing VersaLand kind of like a paradise. It seems like a little bit. Well, if you're a farmer out there, tell us what you think of the new ideas that are being thrown around this hour. We'd like to have your input as well. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back with more from Courtney White, Jeff Biggers, and Grant Schultz in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about climate change and other environmental problems today with Courtney White, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. That's the title of his new book, and it's really interesting in taking a what you might say is a small approach to very big problems, writing about solutions that are already in practice. Nothing needs to be invented. people making these changes here in Iowa and around the world, which Courtney White has visited them, making profits, so not really having to sacrifice anything to do a lot of good for the health of our land. Also with us, Jeff Biggers, founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa, and Grant Schultz, founder and farmer in Johnson County, founder of VersaLand. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We're on Facebook, and you could also tweet us at IPR Talk. I wanted to Courtney, have a quote from you from, I think, your website, perhaps in your book as well. We live in what sustainability pioneer Wes Jackson calls the most important moment in human history, meaning we live at a decisive moment of action. The various challenges confronting us are like a bright warning light shining in the dashboard of a speeding vehicle called civilization, accompanied by an insistent and annoying buzzing sound requiring immediate attention. That's a great image for us. We have that light and that buzzing going on right now.
We do, and I chose that imagery, that metaphor, because we like to fix things. We like to turn annoying lights off in the dashboard, right? We like to get under the hood and do stuff, and that's the point of the book, is that we know what to do. We know how to fix these things. We know how to turn that light off. It is annoying. It's getting louder, it's not complicated from a practical grassroots perspective. It is complicated more on the thinking level, the paradigms, the way we look at the world, our expectations, and things like that. You know, trying to change our minds and look at the world differently, but not necessarily on the practices themselves. We know what tools to use. We know that we have to get under the hood. We know we got to turn the sound off. But are we willing, you know, to slow the vehicle down first, get out, and even try? And that's the question we're having.
Courtney White, you as you can see, if you have a look through this book, you travel the world to Europe, to Australia, to Africa, to look at where these solutions are being implemented. But back to the dashboard metaphor there, in the United States, you have a chance to compare our politics of environment and climate change to the rest of the world. I guess I don't know how you would translate your metaphor to the United States. We have a significant number of people who don't recognize the warning signals as you do, or don't see the lights flashing and the buzzers, hear the buzzers buzzing.
Well, I would say 5 or 6 years ago that would be true. But I think today everybody's got a backyard story now about strange weather, things not usual, going the same. Where I live out here was a former ranch. It's now a subdivision, and the old ranch roads now have all these erosion issues on them. It didn't have 5 years ago. That's because we've had these big storms. So I think folks understand from their own backyard perspective that something odd is underway. It's got different names. We call it climate change, global warming, whatever. But I think people understand, and I think in the back of their minds they're beginning to wonder, well, what do we do about it? How that translates and moves up the political scale to action from our political leaders, you got me. I don't know what story we could tell that would change people's minds in Congress, except just to kind of keep beating on the door here saying, hey, this stuff is not made up.
Okay. Jeff Biggers, in your op-ed piece in the New York Times recently, you talked about this titled Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom. Give us some of the other wisdom that you describe in that article.
Sure. And I think even to follow up with Courtney, I think a lot of the gridlock we're seeing in Washington because of the reality of the lobbies from the oil and coal industry, for example, and I think we've all followed the story of Exxon's cover-up of the climate change studies. I think a lot of people here in Iowa are basically saying we can't wait on Washington and that the rural areas and towns and cities have to take the lead. And that's what really got my attention, to see small towns like Frytown, just outside of Iowa City, you know, opening up the largest solar farm in the state, basically saying this is a very common sense approach for farmers in the Kelowna area. And then you have just further down the road going to Crawfordsville, where a school was financially in trouble and realized a lot of their monies went to maintaining their utilities and electricity. And so they shifted, thanks to a recent decision in the Supreme Court, to primarily going towards solar energy and installing solar panels on the schools. 90% of their electricity now will be coming from solar energy. And not only is it lessening their carbon footprint and providing cleaner energy, but it actually is a way of being very cost effective and saving the school district in a rural area. And then if you go back up into another area of rural Iowa, you have towns like Bloomfield, who basically said, hey, how do we become 100% energy independent? And we have 136 municipal utilities here in Iowa. And I think they're leading the way by saying, hey, we can begin the transition away from natural gas and coal and look at these cleaner alternatives, renewable alternatives through wind and solar, and we can do it ourselves. And these are sort of the small town things that I think a lot of us in the bigger cities really could learn a lot from.
1-866-780-9100. Eric dialing in from Ames. Eric, what's your slant on this conversation?
Well, I'm an architect, and I'm also a Soil and Water Conservation District Commissioner in Dallas County. And I got into it because I'm very concerned about the environment. And I know that the no-till aspect, I mean, I know we've kind of shifted from that topic, but you know, it's very difficult to get farmers, landowners to do this because I've tried. The bigger producers, it's all about the financial costs. If there's a reduction in their yields and items like that, that it's tough to get them to make that change when they're doing that monoculture crop year after year, and then they, you know, build a confinement and they spread the manure and they're able to do those things. So it's tough. It's a tough thing to change.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying you want some other ideas? Are there ideas out there? Grant Schultz, you were convinced. What did you say, 160 acres your farm?
145.
145 yeah. Acres. It sounds like it's really nice looking. You've got, 30,000 trees that you planted in the last couple of years.
Yep.
A lot of wildlife thriving there. So what convinced you, or what? Maybe you're not the typical farmer that needs convincing. What are your ideas about this issue that Eric raised?
There's a couple different issues at play there. I mean, I was a generation removed from the farm, so I skipped a generation. I came back to the land, so I didn't have this fixed mentality of what was possible and what was impossible. So I was able to open it up and just say, okay, what's the best thing to do for the land, for this landscape, both from a financial perspective and from an ecological perspective. You get a lot of producers that they're really hungry for quote-unquote acres. They want to expand their operations by any means necessary because their equipment set gets to be so burgeoning. There's the idea of infrastructure inertia. It's just there's so much money tied up in combines that you've got to be able to make the payment every year, so you have to maintain a certain scale. And when you're so overburdened with that, or when you're focused solely on the profit, by leasing land on an annual basis, you don't know if it's going to be there the next year. So you have no intrinsic motivation to aid in the development of that land or its restoration or its just upkeep, that your motivations are different. So I think that by having farmers own more land, I mean, I think something like 60% of Iowa land is leased on an annual basis with no guarantees of the future. So promoting long-term leases, having landlords offering incentives to, hey, plant a tree. Don't push it over and rip out the fence. Put up a new fence. Plant some trees. Things like that will aid in those sorts of transitions.
Eric and Ames, if you're still there, react to what Grant just said.
Well, yeah, I think that's great. The problem I see with the last comment was that most of those SD landlords, again, they're just interested in the problem. They bought the farmland because they saw it as a rising values as, over the years, and so I think it's just going to be tough. I sit with three different farmers on our Soil Conservation Commission, and those three guys probably do the state average of around 300 to 400 acres farm each, and they claim that they probably do 90% of all the conservation practices that occur in Dallas County. Mm. And that's a remarkable indictment against the farmers of that county.
So just a few players. Just a few players on board so far.
Yeah, my neighbor, the big farmer, is well over 1,000 acres. And, you know, and everything's tilled. He's got the anhydrous he's already put down. You know, I mean, it doesn't fit his business mode. I mean, and it's when you hear these commodity groups arguing that the farmers are working on it, not very many of them, and it's it's hard sell to these people who are looking just at their bottom line.
Okay, Eric in Ames, thank you so much for your input. Eric dialed 1-866-780-9100. A tweet from David asks the kernel of the question that we've been dancing around here. How do we change the narrative from what the market says the narrative should be? The market says...
I would say define the market narrative. I mean, I'm very much a free market believer, and I think that with the current level of subsidization of agriculture, you have to then subsidize better practices, right? So mm-hmm. rather than throw all kinds of money at both sides of the issue, if you remove it and the market is a truly free market that must implement, then you have to say, okay, well... Number one, oil is no longer subsidized, so we have to value the true cost of oil. So we have to use as little oil as possible to be the most profitable we can be.
Right.
In lieu of row crop, commodity-based subsidization. So if crop insurance is heavily subsidized in the U.S. for row crops, so you literally can't fail if you're planting corn and have crop insurance.
So according to Wright, subsidies, current subsidies, farm subsidies right now sort of distorting what should be a better narrative for the health of our land?
I believe so.
Yes, and I think there's two parts to that. One, I mean, kind of the idea behind the book, which I wrote for a general audience, just to kind of raise the profile of an alternative narrative to the one that comes out of agribusiness, is to try to excite consumers. You know, there's a marketplace there. Most of them don't know these alternatives exist. They're aware of some of them, but largely these stories are kept in the dark. And if the marketplace, in that sense, folks who buy food, which is everybody, and drink water and that kind of stuff, and worry about the climate, there's a large potential market force there at work. And the other thing I want to say quickly is in Grass Soil Hope, which is the other book on this that I wrote. At the end, I speculated, what if we created a true sort of a carbon marketplace, meaning in the sense that somehow we compensate landowners for increasing soil carbon, but do it through the system, not necessarily through subsidies. But what's neat about this is that any practice that builds soil carbon is regenerative. You can't deplete land and improve its soil carbon. So then you let the farmers and ranchers decide what the practices are, right? So, but you have maybe a contract with the landowner, increase your soil carbon over a period of time. You choose the practices. We're not going to point a finger at you and say, you do this, you do that. Let them decide, probably the way that Grant decided to go about his farm, and then figure out how to compensate them for improving the land, hopefully not with subsidies.
Before the hour gets away from us, we have less than 10 minutes left. I wanted to have Grant and Jeff talk about a forum that they co-founded, Iowa City Ecopolis. Am I saying that correctly? Jeff Biggers, what is that and who is involved?
Sure. I think a lot of the ideas that we're seeing with Grant and Courtney on a global level, we realize it's not a matter of just they're good things, but they're necessary things that we really have to begin to shift the narrative and shift what our actions are doing. And so here in Iowa City a year ago, a cross-section of people came together to say, how can we begin to learn from these efforts and to bring it into the city, to create a regenerative city, to break this idea that we have to have a linear approach, that if we need electricity, we import it, and then we spew out our waste. If we need food like we do in Iowa, we import 90% of our food and then fill up the landfills. The idea was, how do we begin to have a closed-loop area and to begin to create these things for ourselves, like that is happening in other cities? How do we begin to use our urban waste as part of a compost situation that begins to use back in our agricultural fields? And so Ecopolis was a series of forums to discuss these regenerative approaches to city development. And Grant pretty much kicked it off by saying what he's doing in the rural areas can actually be replicated in many respects in a sense of restoration in town.
Mm-hmm. What can Courtney White, perhaps you can address this. A lot of us are not part of the 2% farmers or ranchers out there. What can everyday Midwesterners do if we're talking small solutions to the big problem of climate change?
Well, as I said, everybody eats food, everybody drinks water. A lot of folks are worried about the climate. And so what I tell folks very simply is to vote with your pocketbook. I mean, find a regenerative farm or ranch like what Grant is doing and support them. Buy their product. attend these meetings, find a way to plug in. Not everybody can sequester carbon in their backyards. Not everybody owns a farm, of course, but there are different ways to participate in the support of these activities. And it's not just food. There's a whole section in the back of the book about wildlife and dung beetles and bears and beavers. Nature has an important role here, too, that we sometimes overlook when we talk about agriculture. And so if you're a conservationist, find those places that are regenerative in their own right, and just find what motivates you and dig in.
Mm-hmm. So many aspects of your book we're not going to be able to get to. Courtney White, 2% Solutions for the Planet. I wanted to ask you and then also follow up with Grant, because he's having this happen on his farm in Johnson County. Wildlife, we haven't even addressed that here. We tend to often think of wildlife for its own sake. Oh, isn't it nice to have that species around, or not, you know, sort of get rid of that species from the planet, to put it that way. But they are part of the world that we need. They're not there just for us to admire. They're part of the system that we're trying to uphold.
Yeah. Yes, and the basic premise of the book is that nature still knows best. Humans tend to think we know best, and we tend to manipulate natural systems to our ends, thinking we know more than nature does. In the long run, nature still has the best ideas, whether it's regenerative agriculture, moving animals around, growing trees, and wildlife fits in here. We can use the models that nature presents us. For example, I talk about dung beetles in a chapter. I mean, nobody thinks about dung beetles, but dung beetles are super important in nature. They clean up manure, they bury all that carbon in the soils, they aerate the soil, but we have poisoned our dung beetle populations across the country. If we could figure out a way to unpoison them, encourage them to come back, that natural process of sanitizing, cleaning up the environment by dung beetles serves all our purposes. And so that's just an example of how we can work in harmony with nature and not keep shoving it around.
Mm-hmm. Grant Schultz, on your 145 acres, what have you seen in terms of wildlife changes now that you've implemented a vastly different landscape than what was there before, the row crops?
I had no previous notion of what the landscape was like, because I wasn't living on site when it was just a corn and soybean farm. But one of the most satisfying experiences that I had was when we were planting these trees in the ground. Red-winged blackbirds, they tend to roost on the highest point they can in a meadow. And literally, we would be planting a tree, and 15 seconds later, the red-winged blackbird would just land on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it would advance towards the tractor as we were putting them in the ground. My neighbors across the road, they noticed an immediate increase in birdsong because there's more natural vegetation versus bombed-out soil or round-up soybeans. So it is immediate, and it is providing habitat for true nature, not necessarily for livestock. So there's a lot of advantages and synergies there.
Some of those, now we talk about pests too, wildlife and being pests. Mm-hmm. When you go to this model, this sort of game-changing model, does it change your idea of what is a pest, or how you think about that, or how
absolutely.
You control pests that will damage your crops?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through by adding diversity and migrating through trophic levels, there's habitat for the birds to eat the insects. There's not these large, vast expanses of monocultural practices. So by increasing the edge, the edge area of any habitat, you're improving total diversity, which tends to level out pest pressures. Mm-hmm. So you're not having that impact. It's great.
Can I ask Grant, are you planting hedgerows? Because hedgerows are a great habitat for things that eat insects.
Correct. Yeah. Effectively, my entire farm is a hedgerow every 30 feet on contour in a parallel key line arrangement. So it's a whole lot of hedgerows and a whole lot of harvestable agricultural yield. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think it was in the break, quickly mentioned, Grant Schultz, how you use technology to come up with planting of what you have there, the trees, the hedgerows, and so forth.
Yeah. So for our model is considered reasonably innovative, but the entire farm was surveyed with RTK GPS equipment, accurate to within 1 centimeter from space. And we designed the entire layout on a CAD program, software, and we laid it out using an autosteer tractor. So in 6 hours, we laid out all of these parallel rows, which hug the landscape. They're curvilinear. They work with nature rather than against it. They retain water versus drain it away. And we're creating diversity and a harvestable, mechanized yield at the same time.
Okay. Okay, very quickly before we have to go, I wanted to end with Courtney, but also perhaps Jeff, if we have time. Courtney, you said you have hope. What gives you the most hope? Where will we be in 5 or 10 years if your hopes turn into reality?
Well, my hope is that there's a lot of innovation and entrepreneurial energy at the grassroots level. I mean, we're problem solvers as a culture and as a species, and there's just a lot going on out of view right now and at that grassroots level, and that gives me a lot of hope for the future.
Okay. The last word to you, Jeff Biggers.
Yeah, likewise. I encourage everyone to read Courtney's book, but something that really struck me was the phrase that the soil will save us. And I don't really feel like it's hyperbolic, but in fact, it's a truth that we really have to learn.
The soil will save us. That is a good final phrase for our show today. Thank you very much, Jeff Biggers, founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa, also co-founder of Ecopolyps. I'm going to practice that, but that I think I got it pretty much right there. Grant Schultz, thank you for joining us, coming into our studio, farmer in Johnson County. Courtney White, his new book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. Thank you all for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay. Tomorrow on this program, I don't have my notes. We'll have to find out what that is. Lindsay Moon to thank as well. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.